Good morning, everybody. So we spoke last week and 2 weeks ago about the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah. And we talked about how this is one of the mitzvahs hatuluyas ba'aretz. This is one of the mitzvahs that is only performed in Eretz Yisrael. And the question is, why is it that we perform it here? We'll still get to that. We have to explain that. And as we mentioned last week as well, this mitzvah, contrary to many other mitzvahs that are only performed in Eretz Yisrael, this mitzvah began the moment we came into the land of Israel. We did not wait the 14-year period that we had to wait for many of the other mitzvahs. By this mitzvah, we have to perform it bivo'achem el ha'aretz. Right away, when we come into the land of Israel, we have an obligation to perform the mitzvah immediately. So now, today's shir should be the refuah shlema for Avraham Mordechai ben Altachaya, who's in the middle of a very difficult surgery now. And we're mispallel that our divrei Torah should be a schus for him to have a complete refuah. So let's talk about what our obligation is nowadays. What is the nature of the obligation of Hafrashas Challah in our times, in our generation, living in the diaspora? So we begin by reminding ourselves of the psukim in Parsha Shlach, which outline our responsibility and our obligation of Hafrashas Challah in the first place. Let's look at the psukim in Parsha Shlach. Daber el b'nei Yisrael ve'amarta lehem. Moshe Rabbeinu was told to speak to the Jewish people and tell them the following. Bivachem el haaretz, when you enter into the land. And again, we spoke about this last week, that our obligation of Hafrashas Challah began immediately upon entering into the land. So bivachem el haaretz asher ani mevi eschem shama, when you will come to the land, when you will enter the land that I will bring you. V'haya ba'achalcham milachem haaretz, and then you will sit down to eat the bread of the land. Tarimu truma laHashem. You should go ahead and separate a part for Hashem. Now, it seems over here that the pasuk is referring to challah as truma, which is interesting. And then the pasuk continues, Reishis arisoseichem, the beginning of your batter of dough. Challah tarimu truma. You should go ahead and separate a part of that batch of dough. Kitruma sagoren kein tarimu osa. The same way that when you have crops that grow in the field, you have to separate truma from them, as we discussed last week. So too, when you have the next stage in the process, when you now make those crops into flour, and you now take that flour and make it into dough, now you have to once again separate the same kind of truma. Mereishis hariso seichem, titnu laHashem, truma ledoro seichem. You have to give to Hashem, which we do not do today. We burn it in the oven. We'll talk about why we do that. But basically, we have a mitzvah to be mafrish the challah and then to give it to the kohanim. That is basically the obligation. Now, what is the nature of the obligation of separating challah nowadays? So the Rambam writes very clearly what his position is. Let's look at the Rambam. We'll read it together in number base. When the Rambam discusses the mitzvah of separating truma nowadays, the Rambam writes as follows. Hatruma bezman hazeh. The Rambam says, if you have truma nowadays, if I have a field and I'm growing crops, and now I have to separate truma, what is the nature of my obligation nowadays? Even in Eretz Yisrael, let's say I'm a farmer who has a big farm in Israel, and I have all kinds of produce, what is the nature of my obligation to separate truma nowadays in Eretz Yisrael? Says the Rambam, there are two qualifications that are necessary in order to be obligated in the separation of truma mid'oraisa. In order to be obligated in the mitzvah, you have to have two qualifications, two conditions need to be met. Says the Rambam, number one, She'ein lecha truma shel Torah, I'm sorry, Eina min haTorah ela midrabanan. The Rambam says, nowadays, the separation of truma is only a mitzvah midrabanan. Even if you live in Israel. Even if you live in Israel, it is only midrabanan. Why is that the case? Because you need two conditions to be met in order to be obligated in separating truma. Number one, She'en lecha truma shel Torah ela be'eretz Yisrael bilvad. Condition number one is, the only time you have an obligation to separate truma is if you're in the land of Israel. If you're not in Israel, you certainly do not have an obligation to separate truma. So that's condition number one. So what about if I'm a farmer living in Israel? Why does the Rambam say that I still do not have an obligation, biblically, to separate truma? Says the Rambam, because you're missing condition number two, and that is, bizman shekol Yisrael shav. The only time you have an obligation to separate truma on a biblical level is if, number one, you live in the land of Israel, and number two, you have most of the Jewish people living in the land of Israel as well. So again, if I happen to be a farmer living at a time when most of the Jews are living in the diaspora, I have no obligation to separate truma on a biblical level. That's what the Rambam teaches us, and he learns it from the fact that the pasuk says, bivoachem, when you come into the land, which means bias kulchem. You need that the entire Jewish people should be living in the land of Israel in order to be obligated. If they are not living there, there is no obligation. And the Rambam once again writes this in Hilchos Isurei Bia, look at number Gimel, where the Rambam once again outlines his opinion. Says the Rambam, when we talk about challah b'zman hazeh, when we talk about our obligation to separate challah, that would be the same as our obligation to separate truma. And the Rambam tells us, afilu b'Eretz Yisrael. Nowadays, if I go ahead and I bake dough, even if I'm living in Eretz Yisrael, not only if I'm living in Chutz Laretz, even in Eretz Yisrael, eino shel Torah. My obligation is not biblical in its very nature. Shenemar, bivoachem el haaretz, when you come to the land, and we learn from there, bias kulchem velo bias miktaschem. You need that the entire Jewish people should be in the land of Israel. And if you don't have that, there is no requirement midaraisa of separating truma or separating challah. So everybody will ask, well, you're never going to have every last Jew living in the land of Israel. Sometimes, even if it's a long, big aliyah movement and everyone's going, you're always going to have some straggler who's left behind. Well, we have a concept in challah which is rubo kakulo. As long as you have most of something, it's considered like the whole thing. This is why, let's say, on Pesach night, we don't have to drink the entire cup of wine for each of the dalakosos. Once you drink 50% of it, 51%, that's already considered as if you have drank the whole thing. This is a concept that we find in halacha very often. Rubo kakula. Once you do a part of it, which is the majority, that's already considered as if you have done the whole. And therefore, the Rambam assumes over here as well, once I have 51% of the Jewish people living in the land of Israel, I have now fulfilled my requirement of bias kulchem, and now I am obligated on a biblical level to separate truma and to separate challah. The Rambam now goes into a historical piece here, and that is at the time of Ezra HaSofer, when the Jewish people were in exile and Ezra was trying to encourage everyone to go back. Anyone know history? Anyone know Tanakh? So how many people went back with Ezra? What does that mean? What? Less than a third, certainly. There were very few Jews at the time that Ezra was trying to make a movement to bring everybody back into Eretz Yisrael. Very few of the Jewish people responded to his call. And you would think, Ezra, the famous Ezra, is making a call, he's making a plea that everyone should come back. You would think people would listen. It's not a new thing that people don't listen to rabbis, it's an old thing. So Ezra HaSofer decides it's time to go back, and nobody listens to him. And he goes back to Eretz Yisrael with a very limited number of people, but yet, since he only had a limited number, and most of the Jewish people at the time were living still in the diaspora and not coming along with him, therefore, says the Rambam, even in the days of Ezra, the obligation was not biblical. Because again, even though he created an Aliyah movement, and even though he had some people, he galvanized them to come along with him, but bottom line, since he was missing such a major faction of the Jewish people in the land of Israel, the obligation of Truma at his time was only rabbinic in its nature. This is what the Rambam tells us, and this is clearly his opinion. This is also the opinion of most of the Rishonim, that Truma nowadays and Challah nowadays is only Midrabbanan. And we assume that many of the mitzvahs that apply in Eretz Yisrael are only Midrabbanan. I'm sure many of us are familiar with the whole discussion about the Heter Mechira. When we have Shemitah, it's very difficult for the farmers to go ahead and take off a whole year, and then the next year the crops are also going to be ruined. So there's this concept of a Heter Mechira. Whether it's right or it's wrong is not the topic of our discussion today. But basically, the whole concept of Heter Mechira, if you believe in it, is only because we believe the premise is that Shemitah nowadays is only Midrabbanan. Since Shemitah nowadays is only Midrabbanan, it's only rabbinic in its nature, so then we have room to start coming up with ways out of things. If it would be biblical, if Shemitah nowadays would be on its regular obligation that the Torah describes, we would have no way to go ahead and start playing games with the Heter Mechira, so to speak, or do all kinds of shortcuts to get around the problem. So again, it's a very relevant halacha that nowadays Shemitah is only Midrabbanan, Truma is only Midrabbanan, Challah is only Midrabbanan. But the question is, what difference does it make to us? If we assume that we have an obligation, either a biblical obligation or nowadays a rabbinic obligation, why should that make any difference? The Rambam warns us, lest you think that a rabbinic obligation is something that you shouldn't take seriously, lest you think that just because you have something that the rabbis instituted, you'll say, well, it's not so important. It's not that important that I really pay attention to the details of that halacha. It's only rabbinic anyway. Is God really going to care? Listen to the Rambam. I forgot to put it on here. But the Rambam writes in the beginning, in Shoresh Aleph, the first fundamental principle that the Rambam outlines for us about what he believes everyone has to know about understanding the Torah. The Rambam says, "Kol ma shetzivanu chachamim la'asoso." Everything that the rabbis commanded us to do, v'chol ma shehuzhanu mimenu, or anything that they told us not to do, kvar tziva Moshe Rabbeinu alav hashalom b'sina. Don't think that rabbis just got up one day and made this up out of thin air. Understand, says the Rambam, that this was already incorporated in everything that Moshe Rabbeinu told us from day one. V'hu amru, and this is what Moshe Rabbeinu said to us at the occasion of Har Sinai, al pi ha-Torah asher yorucha, based on the Torah that they will teach you. That's the Torah that you should keep. What does it mean, asher yorucha? So Moshe Rabbeinu was incorporating already at Har Sinai that anything that comes along later in the process, that a Beis Din, that a rabbi comes along and institutes, is something that is biblically binding. And he says later on that this is included in the biblical prohibition of lo sasur min hadavar asher yagidu l'chamo. We have an obligation to listen to the instructions of the Rabbanim. We should not veer from it at all. And therefore, we should take dinim derabbanan as well. This is not something that we just laugh off. It's not something that we don't take seriously. It's something that we have a great degree of seriousness with dinim derabbanan as well. And with that in mind, we have to ask ourselves, well, then what does it make a difference? If truma nowadays, or challah nowadays, is only midrabbanan, is only rabbinic, bottom line, we have an obligation to perform the mitzvah regardless. So why should it make any difference? So the basic principle is, we have a Gemara in Brachos Daf Chaf Aleph. You know, in the morning, everybody's rushing, everyone's doing different things, we go to the gym, or we're doing whatever we're doing. Now, number one, we're not supposed to go to the gym before we daven, and we're not supposed to be doing a million other things before we daven. The Gemara learns from a pasuk, lo sochlu al hadam, you have to do the davening first. You should not eat before davening, you should not do other activities before davening. Again, if taking a shower before davening is going to make you feel more comfortable, it's fine. If going to the gym is going to make you feel more awake or whatever it might be, is one thing. Personally, after I take a little walk, I'm wiped out. I don't feel more awake after I exercise. But anyway, maybe that's me. So the Gemara says, let's say you have somebody who's busy in the morning, and for whatever reason, they're getting the kids out to school, they're busy with the grandchildren, they're busy with whatever they're doing, and they cannot remember whether or not they recited Kriya Shema. Can't remember. Now, how do you not remember? I don't know. But you can't remember whether or not you recited Kriya Shema. So do I have to go ahead and do it again? Or not? Well, the Gemara tells us the principle is as follows. Since my obligation to recite Kriya Shema is a biblical obligation every day, therefore, if a person is unsure whether or not they did it, you better err on the side of caution, and you should go back and do it again. This is the concept that we call Safek D'oraisa L'chumra. Whenever you have a question, whenever you're in doubt about something which is biblical in its nature, we assume that the person always has to be careful and go ahead and do it just to make sure you have performed your obligation. However, what if I have something that is only rabbinic? What if I cannot remember if I davened Shmona Esrei? I know that I said Kriya Shema, but got a few phone calls in the middle, I wasn't allowed to answer, but something happened, the kids were crying, something, and I can't remember whether or not I davened Shmona Esrei. Now, you'll ask, how could a person forget whether or not they davened Shmona Esrei? You know, my father once said to me, I don't understand. How do people always have shilas about whether or not they said Yalav Yav or Mashav Aruch? How do they forget? I don't understand. I understand. It happens to me. So, my father says, are they not looking in the sitter? The answer is, no, we're not looking in the sitter. Or even if we are, we're not paying attention. Often our minds are other places. There's a story that's told about the Baal Shem Tov. When he first started coming to power and he was beginning the movement of the Hasidus, so there were a lot who were very negative about his movement. There were a lot of people who were suspect about it, and they weren't in such favor of it. And there were those who said, yeah, we heard that the Baal Shem Tov has Ruach HaKodesh, and we heard that he's an incredible person, but he's an Am Haaretz. He doesn't know anything. Come on, he wouldn't know what a Paskin HaShaila for if his life depended on it. So they were making fun of him. So they summoned the Baal Shem Tov. This was at the time, at the heat of the disagreement. They summoned the Baal Shem Tov to what they called the Vad Arba HaAratzos. They had a convention, I guess a national convention of rabbis once a year. So they summoned the Baal Shem Tov to come. Let's check him out. Let's see if he knows anything. So it was a pretty embarrassing story in retrospect that this is what they did to the Baal Shem Tov. But anyway, they called the Baal Shem Tov in, and the person who was in charge of it, his name was Abraham Abba. I don't know exactly the history of him, but he was the one who was running the meeting. And he gets up and he says, well, Mr. Baal Shem Tov, they say that you're a big tzaddik, they say that you know how to do miracles, they say you have Ruach HaKodesh, but bottom line, do you know anything? Do you know what a Paskin HaShailah? He says, I think so. So they said, well, today is Rosh Chodesh. What would you do if somebody forgot Yalav Yavo? What's the halacha? It's a pretty obvious question. So they turned to the Baal Shem Tov and said, let's see if he knows anything. What's the halacha if somebody forgot Yalav Yavo today? So the Baal Shem Tov turns to them and he says, it's an irrelevant question. Why? Because in your community, even if I tell you to go and repeat Shemona Esrei, you're going to forget it the second time. And in my community, they would never forget it in the first place. So it's an irrelevant question. So that's the story with the Baal Shem Tov. That's, you know, my father always asks, how is it possible you can forget? Some of us forget, and some of us forget even a second time. When we go back and repeat Shemona Esrei, we still forget. But that's the unfortunate reality. So what's the story if, let's say, a person doesn't remember whether or not they have daven Shemona Esrei? Do I have to go back and daven to err on the side of caution? The answer to that is no. Why? Because my obligation to daven Shemona Esrei is only rabbinic. It's not a biblical obligation. And since it's only rabbinic, we assume safek derabbanan lekula. Whenever we're dealing with something which is only rabbinic and not biblical, we assume that you do not have to go and err on the side of caution. You don't have to go and do it again just to make sure that you fulfilled your obligation. We assume that you have a right to rely on the fact that you probably did it. That's what we're told. So let's play that back into the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah. If you assume that nowadays the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah is only rabbinic, that would make a major difference. Let's say you have somebody who's baking a batch of dough and they cannot remember whether or not they were Mafrash Challah. Can't remember, did I burn it in the oven? Now, how do you forget that? I'm not sure, your whole house smells. But let's say some people, I think, make a batch of dough, put in the freezer or the fridge, and then they're going to bake it tomorrow. Comes tomorrow and they cannot remember, did I do the Hafrashah yesterday or did I not? And they don't know what happened. So should we assume that we have a right to say that since nowadays challah is only rabbinic in its nature, therefore we have a right to rely on safek derabbanan lekula? And if you're not sure whether or not you separated the challah, so forget it. It's not necessary to go ahead and do it. So we find a fascinating case. Let's look at this case in number Dalet on the source sheet. The Gemara and the Mishnayos are full of incredible cases. And my father always points out, often to his Talmidim, that sometimes people say, this case is irrelevant. This case is, why is the Gemara talking about such an obscure, such a crazy case? Never going to happen. My father says, you live long enough, and you're in the rabbinate long enough, everything happens. Everything happens. So here's a case in the Gemara, where we're told the following story. Think about the following case. Gershin is Geyer. You have a Ger that becomes a convert. You have a non-Jew that decides he wants to convert, or she. And they're going through the process, and they're ready to go. And now they decide, I'm so excited about the first Shabbos that I'm going to have as a Jew. I got to bake my own challah. It's very exciting. Now the problem is as follows. When was the dough made? So says the Mishnah. In this galgala kodem shenis gayer, if I made the batch of dough before becoming a convert, then petur mina challah. Obviously, I have no obligation to separate challah because at the time that I went ahead and created this batch of dough, I was not obligated in the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah. Even though when I bake it, I'm now Jewish, but bottom line, when I created the dough itself, I was not a Jew, so I had no obligation. Simple. Achar shen is gayer. What if I go to the mikveh, now I'm a full-fledged Jew, now I decide, I'm so excited, you know what, the first mitzvah I'm going to do is, I'm going to bake challah for Shabbos. I'm very excited about it. Well then, now that you're a full-fledged Jew, obviously you have an obligation just like everybody else. Chayavas bechallah. V'im safek hu, let's say you're not sure. The ger has an appointment at the mikveh to go become a convert, and they're not sure when did they put up the dough. Was the dough created before they went to the mikveh or after they went to the mikveh? Was the dough created before I became a Jew or after I became a Jew? It's a strange case, but perhaps this could happen. So the Mishnah says, in such a case, chayeves b'challah. You have to go ahead and separate the challah in a case where you're not sure. That's what we're told. And this is quoted in Shulchan Aruch and Hilchas Challah, Simen Shin Lamed in Yerudeya. The Rambam writes this as well, that when a ger is not sure whether the dough was created before they became a convert or afterward, you have to err on the side of caution and go ahead and separate the challah anyway. It reminds me, my father once told me the story that there was a girl in NCSY. Every year she used to come to the NCSY convention. And she was a young girl in 9th or 10th grade, but her parents were not Jewish. But she always used to come to the convention because she was very interested in Judaism. So every year she would talk to the madrichim or the madrichot, whoever they were, that she wanted to convert. And they would always talk her out of it. They would say, why do you want to convert now? You're living in your parents' house. You're not self-sustaining. You don't have a job. You're going to have to go ahead and buy your own pots and pans and have your own kitchen. You're going to have to keep Shabbos. How are you going to do this in your parents' house? They're not Jewish. How do you expect to live a life like that? Wait till you're a little bit older. And then when you're on your own and you have your own house and you're getting married or whatever it might be, then you'll consider going ahead and becoming a convert. So every year after year, she came to the NCSY convention, and They kept delaying and delaying and telling her, it's not a good idea, and she had come to know my father through these discussions. One year my father was at the NCSY conference, and they asked him to give a shiur about Hilchos Brachos. So he's giving a shiur, and he notices that this woman is sitting in the audience, so he made sure to add into his shiur that, by the way, the whole discussion of whether or not we recite a bracha and how to recite a bracha is only for somebody who's Jewish. But if somebody is not Jewish, they have no reason to recite a bracha. How can they say Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoseinu? And how can they say Elokei Avraham? And how can they say Asher Kedushanu b'Mitzvos v'Tzivanu? You have not commanded us to do it. You're not Jewish. So he pointed that out. So after the shiur, she came over to him and she said, well, Rabbi, I'm furious. Nobody ever told me that just because I didn't convert that I'm not allowed to recite a bracha. So she was very upset and she said, I'm very hurt by it and I want to convert. End the story. I don't want to be convinced anymore that it's not a good idea. If you're taking away the brachas, I want to convert. So they realized she was very sincere and she really wanted it. So they put together a bezin and they said, we're going to go ahead with the conversion. So my father, who had known her already for a few years, told the other dayanim, let's not make the regular procedure that we go through by a regular convert. There's no need for it here. Now, by a regular conversion, what we do is we ask, are you prepared to keep Shabbos? Are you prepared to do this? Are you prepared to do that? Do you understand the intricacies of certain halachas? My father said, we don't need to ask all the questions. This woman knows everything. She knows all the halachas. She's been coming to NCSY for years. Don't make her crazy. Don't make her nervous. Just ask. Now, the other dayan, who was part of the Bezdin, said, no, Rabbi Shechter, this is the procedure. This is what we do. I don't care that you know her, but this is what we have to do. We're going to ask the questions. We have to do everything as normal. They're back and forth. Anyway, they come to do the Geirus, and this rabbi who's officiating says to the potential convert, well, do you plan to keep kosher? She says, well, do you want me to keep the OU or the star K or the chaf K? And then he says, well, do you understand the halachas of bishul on Shabbos, of cooking on Shabbos? She says, yeah, kli rishon, kli sheni, and hatmana, and shehiya, and chazar, and everything. And then he was beside himself. He couldn't believe it. My father says, you see? So he said, no, you got to keep asking. So he's asking all the questions, badgering her with all these questions, and finally, the last thing that we do before a convert goes into the mikveh is we ask, do you have any questions for us that you're not sure about? Now's your last chance. So they ask her, do you have any questions for us? So she says, yes. You know, it was at the NCSY conference. Rabbi Shechter said that a non-Jew cannot recite a bracha. Well, now we're in the middle of Sfiras HaOmer. Now we're in the middle of counting Sfira. So I counted the first half every night without a bracha. I want to know tonight, when I count Sfira, can I start to count with a bracha? So my father turns to the other rabbi, he says, this is what she's nervous about, and you're asking her if she has to keep kosher. So sometimes we have stories with Geirim that they're so sincere, and sometimes there's confusion, and sometimes there are questions, and that's what the Mishnah tells us here as well, that we had a story with a Geir, and we're not sure when the batch of dough was actually created. So the Mishnah tells us that the principle is, if you're not sure, you have to go ahead and separate the challah, just in case. Ask the Shach the following question. The Shach is one of the foremost commentators on Shulchan Aruch Yerudeya. He's probably one of the biggest geniuses that ever lived. He died at a very young age, but his commentary is one of the most important ones for us to be aware of. So the Shach writes as follows. Why is it that the Ger has to go ahead in this case and separate challah if you're not sure when the challah was created? He says, Hayne Mishum de Safek Isur L'Chumra. That's because you're not sure whether or not you were Mafresh challah. Challah is a mitzvah in the Torah. And therefore, the principle always is Safek Daraisa L'Chumra. Says the Shach, V'tzarach Lomar, and one has to say, Gehainu Dafka Medina. That this whole Shulchan Aruch, this whole case, is talking about days when challah is a biblical obligation. Abel Ha'inna, he says, but nowadays, Dekol challah hi midrabanan, that our obligation is only rabbinic in its very nature. Imkain, if you had a case like this, Patur mi Safek. You would not be obligated to go ahead and separate the challah because you're not sure. Why should you have to do that? Nowadays, our obligation of hafrashas challah is only midrabanan. And anytime you have a mitzvah midrabanan, we assume safek derabanan lekula. There's no reason to go ahead and do it anyway. So that's the Shach's question. And then he says, "Vitzarachin, I don't understand. You look through the Shulchan Aruch. Does the Shulchan Aruch anywhere discuss how one is supposed to go ahead and shecht a carbon in the Beis HaMikdash? Anyone's learned through Shulchan Aruch? No, but the answer is no. Nowhere does the Shulchan Aruch discuss such halachos. Why? Because the Shulchan Aruch was written for us, living in our generation without a Beis HaMikdash. Shulchan Aruch only writes halachos that are relevant to us, and therefore, says the Shach, if the Shulchan Aruch was only written as a guidebook for those of us nowadays, contemporary society, why does the Shulchan Aruch include this halacha at all? This is not relevant nowadays. Nowadays that challah is only rabbinic, why is this included in the Shulchan Aruch at all? I cannot understand it. Okay, is that clear? That's the Shulchan Aruch's question. And this, I believe, would be a very relevant point to our discussion. Now, the reason why it's not so simple, there are a few reasons why the Shach's argument is not so simple, but one reason is the following. And from today's shiur, I hope that we'll get a little bit of the taste of how the whole Torah really comes down to be interconnected, and how you have to know one halacha to understand another halacha, and how you have to apply the principles from various aspects of Shulchan Aruch and daily life in order to have an understanding in mitzvahs hafarashas challah. So let's move to the mitzvah of Dalet Kosos on the Leil HaSeder. What does that have to do with hafarashas challah? You'll see in a minute. So the Gemara tells us that as we drink the four cups of wine on the Seder night, we're supposed to do that in a leaning position. And men do it, women do it, a whole discussion. But leave that aside. You're supposed to lean while you drink the four cups of wine. The Gemara says clearly that that is only a rabbinic obligation. That's not biblical, that's only rabbinic. And the Gemara now is not sure. Which cups are you supposed to lean by? Are you supposed to lean by the first two? Or are you supposed to lean by the last two? The Gemara has a reason why we should assume the first two. The Gemara has a reason why we should assume the second two. And the Gemara is not sure. Nowhere does it say what the rule is. Nowhere are we told which of the four cups are we supposed to lean by. And the Gemara leaves it as a question. So what do? When you have a suffix, when you're not sure what to do, and you're talking about something which is only rabbinic in its very nature, what would you have said? What would you have said? If anyone's listening. Don't lean by any. Why? Because the whole institution of leaning is only midrabanan, and therefore if you're not sure which ones you're supposed to lean by, forget it. Don't lean at all. So why is it that we lean by all four? Why is it that we lean by all four? Suggests the Ran, one of the Rishonim there on the Gemara says, the reason why we lean by all four is because, yes, it's true we have a principle of suffik derabanan lekula, but when it's so easy for you to perform the mitzvah anyway, just go ahead and do it. What are you losing? If it's so easy for you to lean by all four, what does it cost you already? Nothing. Maybe a stained shirt. But what does it cost you? Nothing. And how difficult is it? It's not so difficult. So therefore, says the Ran, even though we have a concept and a principle of suffik derabanan lekula, the Ran suggests that will not apply in a case where it's so easy for you to fulfill your obligation anyway. That's the suggestion of the Ran. Take for another example. The Magen Avraham writes in Hilchos Dalet Minim. So we have an obligation to shake the lulav every day of Sukkos. Is that obligation a biblical obligation or rabbinic? It's a trick question. The answer is it's both. The first day of Sukkos, it's a biblical obligation. The rest of the days of Sukkos, it's only a rabbinic obligation. So let's say you have a person who has the following scenario. I was busy all day Chol HaMoed with the Chol HaMoed trips and whatever. I come home at night. It's now Bein HaShmashos. Now Bein HaShmashos is the time when we don't know, is it still today or is it tomorrow already? And the person cannot remember, did I shake lulav this morning or not? Can't remember what I did. So should I go ahead and shake the lulav during Bein HaShmashos or not? Well, you say, on the rest of the days of Sukkos, it's only a rabbinic obligation. So forget it. Safek derabanan lekula. When you're not sure, you don't know if it's still today or if it's tomorrow, you don't know if you shook lulav or not, why should I have to go ahead and do it? Says the Magen Avraham, wrong. Because even though safek derabanan lekula, but it's so easy for you to do. How hard is it to go and pick up a dalet minim and shake it around? It's going to take you 30 seconds. You put it back down on the table. So of course, you don't recite a bracha, but why not pick it up? Why not do it? That's what the Magen Avraham says. That's what the Ran writes by leaning by all four cups of the Dalet Kosos. And that's also what the Shulchan Aruch says as well. Let's say a person, what's our obligation to wash our hands before we eat bread? It's clear in the Gemara that this is an institution of Shlomo HaMelech. This is not something that was around. It's not a biblical obligation. It's a rabbinic obligation. So what if a person is not sure whether or not they wash their hands? Or if they're not sure whether or not the water that they use was good for the washing of the hands. Should I go ahead and do it again or not? Well, you'll say, Safek derabanan lekula. Says the Shulchan Aruch, no. Why? Because nowadays we have a faucet. It's not like I have to go down to the well and carry a whole bucket of water to wash my hands again. The water's right here. It's available. So why not go do it? It's so easy. So why rely on the concept of Safek derabanan lekula? And that's the same over here. When you have a woman who is Safek hifrisha chalasa, Safek lo hifrisha. You have a woman who got distracted, who cannot remember whether or not she performed the mitzvah of hafrashas challah, and now she's standing there and she doesn't know what to do. So the Shach says, well, nowadays challah is only midrabanan, so we should say, safek derabanan lekula. But perhaps that shach is very questionable. Why? Because, yes, we have a concept of safek derabanan lekula, but when it's so easy for me to fulfill my mitzvah anyway, we assume that you go ahead and you do it. So over here, where it would be so easy, what do I have to do? Just separate a little piece of it? When I'm not sure, just put it aside, put it in the oven? Why is it so hard for you to do that? So in a case like that, we would assume, perhaps, that you would have an obligation to be mafresh the challah anyway, but you should not recite a bracha. The same way when you shake the lulav during Bein HaShmashos, we say, do it anyway, just to err on the side of caution, because it's so easy, but don't recite a bracha. So too over here. There is an added factor that is thrown into the equation, and this is something that's based on a Gemara and Brachos with regard to Kriya Shema. So, you see, when we talk about Hafrashas Chala, we don't limit it to Hafrashas Chala. We have to get to the Halachas of Truma, then we have to talk about Dalet Kosas, then we have to talk a little bit about Kriya Shema, a little bit over here about Dalet Minim. There's a lot to talk about. Arucha Me'eretz Mida Rechava Minayam. The Torah is tremendous. The Torah has a lot of insight. And it's important that we make sure to gain insight from all the different factions, all the different areas of Torah, in order to understand one area in its own, as the many Achronim write, Tivrei Torah Aniyim B'Makam Echad B'Ashirim B'Makam Acher. Sometimes there's very little that's said in the place where you think it's going to be, but it's Ashirim B'Makam Acher. It's rich in another place. So unless you have a rabbi who really understands where to look and how to look and how to find, you have to be very careful as a consumer who you ask a shayla to. Not always is the answer that you're looking for in the place where you expect it to be. Sometimes you have to take an answer from somewhere else. So let's look in the Gemara in Brachos. The Gemara in Brachos, as quoted in Shulchan Aruch, this is number Hey on the source sheet, in Simen Samach Dalet. The Shulchan Aruch tells us in Ilchos Kriya Shema. Let's say a person in the morning is all confused. I come to recite Kriya Shema, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, I haven't gone to the gym, haven't taken my shower, I sit down right away to daven Shacharis in the morning. Now, I'm in the middle of davening Shacharis, and I'm having my Kavana. The problem is, I get distracted. And if you'll notice, in the two parshiyos of Shema, we have the Ahavtas first, and then we have the Hayom Shamoah. Now, we have the very same line at the end of each of those parshiyos. Uchsavtam al mezuzos beisecha v'sharecha is both in the first parsha and in the second parsha. So here I am, I'm rambling, Kriya Shema, I'm going, and now I get up to Uchsavtam al mezuzos beisecha, and I can't remember, where am I up to? Am I in the middle of the first paragraph, or am I in the middle of the second paragraph? Somebody just called, it distracted my attention, my kids are screaming, something's happening, I don't remember where I'm up to. So what am I supposed to do? I know that I said Uchsavtam al mezuzos beisecha, so I definitely don't have to go back to the beginning of Kriya Shema, that's for sure. But should I go to the first paragraph, or should I continue with the end of the second paragraph? What do I do? Says the Shulchan Aruch, the principle, the rule goes as follows. Haya omed beuchsavtam. Let's say I am now up to Uchsavtam al mezuzos beisecha. Ve'eini yodea, and I cannot remember in the Uchsavtam Shebeparsha Rishona. I don't know. Am I up to the Uchsavtam in the first parsha or the Uchsavtam in the second parsha? So in a case like that, Choser the Uchsavtam Shebarishona. You have to go back to the first one. However, let's change up the case a little bit. Let's say you said Uchsavtam Amazuzas Beisecha Visharecha Leman Yiru Yemechem. So you already started with the next sentence. So then says the Shulchan Aruch, well, once you started with the next sentence, we assume, look at the last three words, Sirchei Nakat Ba'azel. The flow of the words probably indicates that you have done it properly, because otherwise, how did you get up to the next sentence? So we assume in a case like that, once you already started the next sentence, once you already started the next paragraph, even though now you're not sure, did I make a mistake, did I not make a mistake, you have a right to assume that you probably did not make a mistake, because otherwise, how did you end up in the next paragraph? How did you end up there? Sirchei Nakat Ba'azel, the regular flow of what you generally say in Kriya Shema, probably got you to that point. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says, and in a case like that, you would have to go back. So take, for example, the Pischei Tshuva in Shulchan Aruch, Yaredeya Hilchos Nida, talks about the following case. We have procedures of what a person is supposed to do before going into the mikvah. So what happens? The procedure always is, you do this, you check that, you go through your hair. Now, you come home from the mikvah, and you can't remember. Did I comb through my hair? Did I get all the knots out or did I not? Can't remember. Can't figure it out. So, what would you say? So, the Noda Behuda argues, maybe I should say, well, since this is the procedure, it's not my first time going to the mikvah. It's not like I just got married, I'm going for the first time. This is something that I do all the time. Since this is always the process and the procedure that I follow, maybe we have a right to assume, Sirchei Nakat Ba'azel. Just like over here. Once you're ready home, once you're ready went up to the mikvah, we assume, how did you get to the next step of the process? You probably did everything along the way to get yourself there. So there's no reason to start questioning whether or not you did it properly. If that's the normal routine, that's what you always do, you probably went along with the flow of things, and you did it properly. Or you take, for example, it used to be when they cooked meat, it was not such a simple process. You would go to the butcher, buy a piece of meat, but then you had to go and salt it. And the salting was not a simple thing to do. And if you didn't salt the meat was treif, because you have blood in the meat, so the meat was treif. So you had a woman who went ahead to the butcher and bought a piece of meat. Now she comes home, and now the meat is already cooked, and she can't remember, did I salt the meat or did I not? I know that I went to the butcher, I know that I seasoned the meat, I know that I did everything I was supposed to do, I know that I cooked it in the oven, I cannot remember whether or not I went ahead and did the process of the salting. So the Taz writes in Yoredeya, we have a right to assume in a case like that, Sirchei Nakat Ba'azil. This is not your first time cooking meat in your life. This is what you do every night of the week. This is what you do every Shabbos or every Yom Tov. Whenever you buy meat, you go ahead and you salt it first and then you cook it. So if you already cooked the meat, we have a right to assume that you probably did it properly because Sirchei Nakat Ba'azil. That's the general way in which you do things. And therefore, this consideration is brought into the equation as well. You have a woman who makes a batch of dough. Now she goes ahead and she bakes it. And she cannot remember, was I mafresh challah or was I not mafresh challah? And she doesn't know. I was distracted, maybe I did, maybe I didn't, it was already yesterday, I can't remember. Maybe, perhaps, we have a right to assume, Sirchei Nakat Ba'azil. This is what you always do every time you make a batch of dough. You always are mafresh challah. So this is not my first time making it. Maybe you have a right to assume. Just like we have a right to assume that the woman perhaps salted the meat, just like we have a right to assume that the woman probably combed through her hair and got the knots out, so too we have a right to assume that the woman was probably mafresh challah. And this is all based on the Gemara, where the Gemara says, if a person is not sure where they're up to in Kriya Shema, Sirchei Nakat Ba'azil. Once you're up to the next paragraph, we assume the flow, the process, is what got you there. And you have no reason to go in retrospect and say, maybe I didn't do it properly. Yes? So this is a very important question. What if a person knows for sure they were not mafresh challah, and now the challah is already baked? It's a very important question. I hope to hold it for the coming weeks, because it's a discussion in and of itself, what we're supposed to do then, and your pans are treif, and it's a big problem. You have to figure out what to do. We'll talk about it. And one caveat that I should mention, maybe we'll get into it in more detail, but one thing that I should mention is, if a person ever has a shaila like that, call the rabbi right away. Because once you wait 24 hours, it's a bigger problem. It's a bigger problem. So if you catch the mistake within 24 hours, it's okay. If you catch it after 24 hours, it's still okay, but you have to figure out how to make it okay. So it's not so easy. So this is a consideration that's raised about a person who is not sure whether or not they were mafresh challah. Perhaps some say you have a right to assume that Sirchei Nakat Ba'azil, that I probably went along with the flow of things and I probably did it the way I was supposed to, and therefore we should assume that there's no reason to go ahead and do it again. Now, these are all questions I think halacha l'maisa we would tell anybody, why not? It's so easy, you may as well err on the side of caution. No reason to assume that you haven't done it. No reason to rely on Safik Rabbanan Lekula. Do it again and don't recite a bracha. In fact, there are those who argue, when you think about the two cases, the parallel that we make between Kriya Shema case and over here by, let's say, salting the meat or taking the knots out of the hair or the case of Hafrashas Challah, those aren't exactly the same. Over there, maybe you have a right to assume that I'm in the role. Already I'm saying the words of Kriya Shema, I'm on my way, I'm in the routine, so I probably continued the way I was supposed to. Over here, there's another step in the process that's necessary. Over here, you have to salt the meat. Over here, you have to be mafresh the challah. Over here, you have to comb out the hair. Who said that you, just because you're in the routine, who said that you did the extra step in the process that is not part of what you were doing before? So the parallelism is not exactly the same, and therefore maybe there's room to question whether or not we have a right to rely on it here. Therefore I would suggest that anyone who has a question like this should go ahead and be mafresh challah without a bracha once again, just to err on the side of caution, just to be sure. Now, all of our discussion today was based on the premise that Hafrashas Challah nowadays is only midrabanan. And again, the reason why we make that assumption is because the Rambam says you need two conditions to be met in order to have a biblical obligation of Hafrashas Challah. Number one, you have to live in Eretz Yisrael. Number two, even if you live in Eretz Yisrael, your obligation is only going to be biblical if you have Bias Kulchem, if you have most of the Jewish people living in the land. So now, this is a major question. How many Jews live in the land of Israel nowadays? Every year or two, this discussion comes up again. Are we at a point where we're so blessed that perhaps we have 51% of the Jewish people living in Israel? It's going to become a little bit closer when you move. But that's a question. Should we assume that now, since there's such a strong Aliyah movement, maybe we're at a point where 51% of the Jews actually live in Israel and are no longer in the diaspora? And this is a question that's raised every couple of years. If that's the case, then we have to start reevaluating once again whether Chalas Daraisa, whether Chumas Daraisa, and that would make a major difference in the way we paskin many different Shilas. If you have 51% of the Jewish people living in the land now, maybe we should actually say that our obligation nowadays in Israel would be reverted back to be the original biblical Halacha Midaraisa, which would change a lot of different aspects of the mitzvah itself. Something to think about, something just to consider, the blessings of our times. So as we said, Hafrashas Chala consists of two parts. Part number one is that you have to separate. Part number two is you have to give it to the Kohen. Nowadays we don't give it to a Kohen. We'll talk about why that's true. But that is really the mitzvah. And there's a question in the Rishonim, how exactly do you categorize this mitzvah? Do you assume that this is just one big mitzvah that has two different parts? Part one is to separate. Part two is to give it to the Kohen. Or do you assume that these are two mitzvahs that have nothing to do with each other? One is you have a mitzvah number one to go ahead and separate, a mitzvah number two to go ahead and give it to the Kohen. And this is something that doesn't only come up by the mitzvah of Hafrashas Chala, it's something that is relevant to other halachas as well. Look at number Vav, where the Rambam writes clearly, we have a mitzvah every day to offer two karbanos in the Beis HaMikdash, a karban tamid shel shachar, one karban tamid in the morning, and a second karban tamid in the afternoon. Now the Rambam writes, when he talks about that mitzvah of offering the two karbanos every day, it's the same question. Should you assume that those are just two parts of one greater mitzvah? I have one greater mitzvah that says, offer two karbanos tamid every day, one in the morning, one in the evening. Or do you say, no, those are two separate mitzvahs. One is a mitzvah to offer a karban in the morning, and there's a separate mitzvah to offer a karban in the afternoon. So this, the Rambam weighs in on the issue. And he says, Shetzivanu lahakriv migdash, we have an obligation to offer a sacrifice in the Beis HaMikdash, Shnei Chivasim Echol Yom, two offerings every day. Ve'elu hanekra matmidim, these are called the Karban Tamid. V'hu amr yisala shnayim layom alas tamid. Says the Rambam clearly, unequivocally, that this is only considered to be one mitzvah. Happens to have two different parts. You happen to fulfill those two different parts at two different times in the day, but you have one mitzvah. What's another example of such a case? Kriyashma. We have an obligation to recite Kriyashma every morning and every evening. Is that considered two separate mitzvahs, or is that considered to be one big mitzvah that you just have two different times that you have to perform them? So this is a question that comes up by Karban Tamid, by Kriyashma, by many other things, by Ketoros. You have an obligation to offer the Ketoros in the Beis HaMikdash every morning, every evening. And this is a question that the Rambam and the Ramban disagree about by all of the cases. And the Rambam consistently writes that these are considered to be one mitzvah. And so too by Hafrashas Chala, the Rambam writes, and so too by Hafrashas Truma, the Rambam says, these are all considered one mitzvah. Number one, to separate. Part one of the mitzvah is to separate. Part two of the mitzvah is to give it to the Kohen, but we don't count that as two separate mitzvahs. That's considered one mitzvah of Hafrashas Chala, one mitzvah of Hafrashas Truma, that happens to have two different components to the greater whole. Now, when we talk about the mitzvah of Hafrashas Chala, there's a major question as to the nature of this mitzvah. Take for example, we have certain mitzvahs throughout the year which we know are mitzvahs that we have to fulfill. For example, shaking the lulav on Sukkot, we know that we have to do. Going ahead and hearing the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, we know that's something that we need to do. It's what we call a mitzvah chiyuvis. Everybody's obligated to do it. Yes, mitzvah seishas mangrama, if you're busy, whatever, but we assume that there are certain mitzvahs that we know we are obligated to do. There are other mitzvahs, take for example, Torah tells us that a person who wants to divorce his wife has to go through this certain procedure, write a get, this is exactly the way you do it, benasam b'yada, put it in her hand, that's the way you do it. So does everybody have an obligation to go ahead and divorce their wives? Well, after all, the Torah says, here's the mitzvah of writing a get. So the same way I have to shake lulav, and the same way I have to blow the shofar, I should also have an obligation to write a get to my wife. Why is that not the case? Don't worry. Why is it not the case? It's my mother-in-law. So why is it not the case? The answer is because we have two different categories of mitzvahs. Some mitzvahs we assume are what we call a mitzvah chiyuvis. You have an obligation to do this mitzvah, like shofar, like lula, like anything of that nature. You have other times where you have, the Torah just tells you the procedure. If you want to have a license to go ahead and marry somebody else, this is the procedure that you need to go through in order to do that. if you want to have a permit or an authorization to be able to go ahead and do something, this is how you're going to get to that point. This is how you're going to accomplish it. And this is a major question by many mitzvahs. Let's take, for example, the following. Mitzvah of hafrashas truma. So you're not allowed to eat any of the produce before you separate the truma. What if a person's a farmer and there's such an excess of produce this year? We're not going to sell it, we're not going to use it, we're going to dump it into the river. Which happens to be a big shaila. Shouldn't laugh, it's a real question that comes up. Let's say nowadays when we want to keep the market at a certain value, we don't want the apples to be too expensive or too cheap. So what if we have an excess in apples one year? So what do they do in the Israeli government when there's an excess in apples? Guess what? They dispose of them. Throw them into the river. Which leads to a major question, isn't that baltash? How are we allowed to actively throw things into the river and dispose of all this food that is edible just because we want the market to be at a certain rate? So this is a major discussion. But what if you're one of those farmers and you're going to dispose of all your produce because there's an excess this year or this season, there's too much and we're not going to sell it. Nobody's going to eat it. Do you still have an obligation to go ahead and separate the truma before you dispose of it? Is our obligation of hafrashas truma like shaking a lulav? Torah says, whenever you grow produce, go ahead and separate the truma. Just like the Torah says, whenever you come to the time of year of Rosh Hashanah, you should go ahead and blow the shofar. And whenever you come to the time of year of Sukkot, you should shake the lulav. So too the Torah says, whenever you have the crops, you should go and separate truma. Or does the Torah mean something different? Does the Torah only mean that if you want to eat from those crops, if you want to have benefit from those crops, then the only license that you have to do so is if you first separate the truma from the produce? That's the general question. Take for example, we have a mitzvah, a very unfortunate mitzvah called the mitzvah of chalitza, which means if you have somebody who's married and the husband passes away and they did not have any children, and there happens to be a brother of the husband who is alive. So the mitzvah is that the woman is supposed to go ahead and marry the brother of her deceased husband. Now that never happens. We go ahead and do step B of the process, which is instead of marrying, you either have the option to marry, which is called yibum, or you have the option of chalitza, which is the process of taking the shoe off the foot, whatever it is, that whole story. Parshas Ki Tse, we'll get there soon. So the story of chalitza is an unfortunate story. But what happens if you have a woman who unfortunately is married to her husband for 80 years, and she got married at 20. Now she's 100 years old, they never had children. I didn't mean to. It's not unfortunate that she was married to her husband for 80 years. It's unfortunate that she was married to her husband for 80 years and never had children. So she's married to her husband for 80 years, didn't have children, now the husband passes away. Now she's 100 years old. She's not marrying somebody else. Somebody was upset last night when I said that because they said that in the nursing homes apparently they do make a lot of shidduchim between people who are over 100. I don't know. Okay, so she's 119. So, you know, my father told me recently, somebody said to him that, what do you wish somebody on the day of the 120th birthday? Have a wonderful day. Anyway, so if you didn't get it, it's fine. But so anyway, you have here a woman who's 100 years old. There's no chance that she's interested in getting remarried. She's been living with the same person for 80 years. She's not capable of being married to somebody else and learning a whole new house. It's not possible. So now she dies without children, and she has no plans on getting remarried. Does she have a mitzvah to go ahead and do the chalitza with the brother of her husband? Huh? So is it only if she wants to get married that it gives her the license to go ahead and get married? Or is it something that we say, no, it's like shaking a lulav. It's like blowing the shofar. The Torah says when the husband dies, this is what you need to do. The question basically is, the way we call it in halacha is this a mitzvah like every other mitzvah, or is it just a matir? Is it just something that allows me to go ahead and do the next step of the process, like by giving a get? Giving a get, do I have an obligation to go ahead and give my wife a get? Obviously not. It's just a matir. It allows my wife to go ahead and get remarried if she so chooses to do so. So that's the same question by chalitza. Take, for example, Erev Tavshilin. I love asking women this question because it makes the men so embarrassed. When do we make an Erev Tavshilin? Only the women know. The men have no idea. When Shabbos comes after Yantif. You know, they say the story that in Europe there was a gabbai in the shul who made the announcement when it was Shabbos and then 2 days of Yantif. He made the announcement on Erev Shabbos, by the way, everyone should go home today, don't forget to make an Erev Tavshilin. There happened to be a rabbi who was visiting in the community, And he goes over to the Gabbai afterward. He says, you know, I just want to point out to you, you only make an Erev Tavshilin, I think, when you have Shabbos that comes after Yom Tov. You don't have an Erev Tavshilin in the other direction. He says, yeah, that's some opinions, but the other ones hold this way. So the truth is that the men don't know the halacha. But an Erev Tavshilin is made only when you have Shabbos that follows after a Yom Tov. So, right. That's a very good question. That's a very good question. I think the answer to that is that the Torah gives us two options, two venues of how we can get by the problem. Either we can do Yibum, or we can do Chalitza. The question is, if you have chosen the option of Chalitza, is that something you're obligated to do? Or is it something that, no, if you choose to get married at a certain point, you do the Chalitza, but if you don't, so maybe you don't have to. I think the question is a strong one, but let me... Okay. No, it's a very good question. It's a very good question. I like the question. Thank you. So let's talk about, let's say, Erev Tavshilin. So let's say you have the Erev Tavshilin when you're supposed to make the Erev Tavshilin, which is when Yom Tov comes before Shabbos. And you know your oven is broken and you're not going to cook anything. Let's say my wife is away for Yom Tov. I'm not going to get near the kitchen. I'm not cooking anything. I'm not doing any malach. I'm not doing anything. Is there any reason for me to go ahead and make an Erev Tavshilin? Or, somebody gave an example last night, which was a very good one, what if I'm in a hotel? Right? So somebody in the hotel is going to make an Erev Tavshilin on behalf of all the cooking that's going on for all of us, but I'm not cooking anything. I don't have a burner in my room. I don't have an oven in my room. I'm relying on the hotel to do everything. Should I make an Erev Tavshilin in a case like that? Or do you assume no? An Erev Tavshilin is not a mitzvah like shaking lulav. It is just a matir. It's the license for you to go ahead and cook on Yom Tov. But if you don't need that license, says Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, there's no reason to go ahead and make an Erev Tavshilin. Why would you do that? And certainly not to make a bracha. Why would you do that if you have no plans or no intention on cooking at all? So this is a discussion that comes up all over the place. It is a discussion that comes up, as we said, by separating Truma. It's a discussion by Chalitza. It's a discussion as well by Erev Tavshilin. It is also a discussion, let's say, by Tvilas Kelim. You buy an item from a non-Jew. Now you have an obligation to go ahead and put it into the mikvah. I would imagine. Let's say I go to the store and I see that there's a set of pots that's on sale and I'm not going to use it now. I'm going to save it for Pesach. So what do? I'm not going to go to the mikvah today and put it all in the mikvah. I'm not interested. I'm going to put it downstairs where I have all my Pesach things, I would imagine. You're going to put a big sign on it that says, don't forget, this is not toveled yet. Right? Am I the only one that does this? Thank you. So I'm going to put it down there. Pesach time, when it rolls around, when I go to the mikvah to do everything else for Pesach, so I'm going to do this as well. Is that correct? Is that the right thing to do? Let's say I wake up on Rosh Hashanah and I have an option to either listen to the shofar now or listen to the shofar later. So you say, I'm busy now. What? I have to go listen to the shofar? I'll wait till 5 o'clock this afternoon. No, we have a principle, Shihu Mitzvah Lo Mashino. We don't just wait around. When you have an obligation to do, you do it right away. So how come when it comes to the mitzvah of Tvilas Kelim, does anyone in the right mind say that you have to go ahead and go and put it into the mikvah the minute you buy it? No, why not? What? No. Because perhaps the whole nature of the obligation of Tfilas Kelim is a matir. It's just a permit for me to allow myself to use these items. But if I'm not planning on using them right now, I don't have to do it. It's not a mitzvah like the general sense of a mitzvah. This is what we call the category of a matir. And that, let's just rein this all in, 1 minute, let's just rein this all back in to the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah. Took a little bit of a tour, a panoramic view of many different halachas, but now let's take it back to Hafrashas Challah. What if you have somebody who makes a batch of dough and now says, I can't believe it, I made the wrong recipe, my kids aren't going to eat this thing, throw it out, right? I would imagine that never happens, but what if you have something of that nature, or you have no plans on eating it at all? Do you have to go ahead and be Mafrash Challah? Because once you put together the dough, we assume, now you're obligated to go ahead and separate the challah. Or do you say no? The nature of my obligation of Hafrashas Challah is only when I have an interest in eating it. But if I have no interest in eating it, since the nature of the mitzvah is just a matir, it's just something that permits me to eat, it's something that gives me the authorization to eat, but if I'm not planning on eating, perhaps I should have no obligation to do it at all. So this is a general question that comes up by many different mitzvahs. So let's just quickly recap everything we spoke about today. We started in today's shiur that the nature of the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah is certainly a biblical one. However, nowadays the Rambam says, since number one, we don't live in Eretz Yisrael, and number two, even if we did live in Eretz Yisrael, since we don't have most of the Jewish people living there, the nature of our obligation changes from being a biblical one to now being only rabbinic. This is what the Rambam tells us. What's the difference if our obligation is biblical or rabbinic? Either way, don't we have an obligation to follow what the rabbis say? The answer is, well, we have a basic principle that anytime you have a rabbinic decree, if you're in a case of doubt, if you're not sure if you have fulfilled your obligation, we generally assume, safek d'rabbanan l'kula. If you have a biblical mitzvah that you have to fulfill and you're not sure whether or not you did it, we say in a case like that, safek d'oraisa l'chumra. You have to go ahead and do it again, err on the side of caution. So maybe we should suggest that when we come to somebody who's not sure whether or not they were mafresh challah, maybe we should say the regular principle of safek d'rabbanan l'kula. And since nowadays challah is only mid'rabbanan, you should have no obligation to go ahead and do it again. However, we suggested that that is not something to rely on. Why? Because, as we see from the Ran by leaning by the Dalet Kosos, as we see from the Pri Megadim by shaking the lulav during Bein Hashmashos, if a person has a very easy way of fixing the problem, even though we know it's only a mitzvah midrabbanan, but if you have an easy way of fulfilling your mitzvah midrabbanan, you should not rely on the principle of safek d'rabbanan l'kula, and therefore by chala as well. Even though it's only midrabbanan nowadays, we assume you should do whatever you can, since it's such an easy mitzvah to fulfill. You just have to separate a little bit. You should go ahead and do it anyway. We threw in the factor into the equation of maybe you should assume that sirchei nakat v'azel. Maybe we should assume a woman would not have to be mafresh challah when she's not sure whether or not she did, because since this is the normal process, this is what I always do, so I probably did it the same way I normally otherwise would have. Just like we find in the Taz by the woman who's not sure if she salted the meat, just like we find in the Nodi Yehuda, but a woman is not sure whether or not she combed out her hair before going into the mikvah. So maybe we should say over here as well that sirchei nakat v'azel. When I go ahead and bake my bread, I probably did all the steps that led up to that process as well. So that's a question, and I think halacha lemaisa, we would tell everybody to, in a case like this where they're not sure whether or not they were mafresh challah, we would suggest that you should go ahead and do the hafrasha again and not rely on any of these kulas. However, you should not recite a bracha, just like you wouldn't recite a bracha by shaking the lulav during Bein Hashmashos. We then talked about whether nowadays we should assume the nature of the mitzvah changes back to be a daraisa, because nowadays we have most of the Jewish people living in Eretz Yisrael were very close to it. So maybe that should change. It's something to keep in mind. And finally, the last thing we spoke about was the general category of mitzvahs that we have. Some are a mitzvah and some are a matir. You have some mitzvahs that are like shaking lulav, some mitzvahs that are like blowing shofar, and you have other category of mitzvahs which are like giving a get, which is only a matir. It's something everybody has an obligation to do. And that's the general question when we come to the mitzvah of hafrashas challah and the mitzvah of hafrashas truma. Should we assume that this is a mitzvah, it's an obligation that you have to do regardless of whether or not you plan to eat it? Or should we assume that this is only an obligation that you have if you plan to go ahead and eat or derive benefit from the produce or from the bread itself? The mitzvah next week, we will continue.